When you think of the island of Ibiza, there is one venue that needs no introduction as the most iconic institute in nightlife, where the epicenters of heritage, music, and glamour have combined since 1973. For five decades, Pasha has been at the pulse of Ibiza's dance and cultural movement, where the Cherries and the Island of Freedom go hand in hand. And this year, they've been celebrating their 50th year anniversary, which is a monumental milestone in the notoriously difficult world of nightlife. In today's episode of the Mission Makers podcast, we're extremely lucky to be joined by Sanjay Nandi, who is the CEO of the Leo Group and former CEO of the Pasha Group. Sanjay's journey has seen him wear many C-suite hats, from Chief Operating Officer to Chief Development Officer, steering Pasha and the Leo Group through the ever-changing tides of the nightlife industry. Sanjay has been a true titan in hospitality for the last two decades, where he's led brands such as Horvada and Toy Room to unparalleled heights of success. And prior to the hospitality industry, Sanjay was a pivotal member of the Lehman Brothers Mergers and Acquisitions Department in London, participating in deal values in excess of $40 billion. We recorded this interview over the summer, just before the Pasha Group was split in two, and before Sanjay took on the stewardship of the Leo Group. In today's episode, we unravel the incredibly special layers behind a story that is a testament of the enduring spirit of creativity, entrepreneurship, and passion that defines the very essence of Pasha. So, welcome to Mission Makers. We are sat in this incredibly iconic venue that once used to be the legendary Café de Paris, now turned into Leo London, which is owned by the Pasha Group. And I'm sitting with the CEO, Sanjay Nandi. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Very good, thank you. And it's great to have you here and excited.
Amazing. We've got one whole hour of grilling. No, I'm joking. But you started your career working in Lehman Brothers in the M&A section. So my first burning question for you is, how did you make that transition into nightlife? Like, what sparked that interest to shift industries?
I get that question a lot. And to be honest, love talking about it. I mean, to be honest, as far as hospitality is concerned, you know, I grew up in India with my father, who was an admiral in the Navy, and, you know, we used to host people at home. And so that's probably where I got my initial training in hospitality, like hosting parties. And then I did have a career in finance at Lehman and M&A, but it was more in the consumer space, so doing deals in pubs and restaurants. And then from there, sort of natural progression into private equity, where again we had investments in, I was looking after investments in restaurants, clubs, hotels, and then sort of came to the point where I said, this private equity is not really for me. I wanted to set up businesses, to run businesses, to lead people, to really sort of create value in that respect. So I quit and started sort of restaurants in London, which is extremely competitive and great fun, but extremely competitive. And from there, sort of landed a role in Pasha, running operations, and then, you know, and then onwards.
Did you feel anything daunting about quitting, you know, what you already knew and going completely outside of your comfort zone and switching to something completely different and new and, as you say, quite competitive as well?
I knew it was something that I enjoyed, and I had always, I guess, some sort of a desire to move into this industry. It's a very alluring industry, because, you know, unfortunately, I say unfortunately, but, you know, it has low barriers to entry. So you can enter the industry, but that doesn't mean you succeed. So of course I was concerned. I took time off from when I left banking. And, you know, worked in kitchens. I worked at cafes. I've been a runner in a restaurant. And, you know, often would get questions like, "Oh wow, you know, you're quite old to be a runner." And I said, "Well, change of career." And they said, "Well, you must have been really shit at your previous job." So, but you know, you get through all this, and it's all experience. It's all learning. So of course, it was daunting. and it still is, given the scale of what I manage now. But it's great fun, and I'm so glad I did it.
Brilliant, brilliant. So for our second question on this podcast, we love to go deeper into our guest's name and the meaning behind it. I know you saw the questions before, but were you aware of like the meaning of your name? Yeah, absolutely. Cool. So for context for our viewers, the name Sanjay has roots in Sanskrit, and it's derived from two words, San and Jaya. So San means complete and whole, and Jaya means victory or success, which is quite fitting given what you've achieved, as a businessman. But how do you feel, you know, that has related to your identity? Like, how has that played on you, you know, growing up and that meaning?
Yes, I mean, I'm grateful for the name, for my parents naming me that way. But I have to say, I am definitely not, that's not how I see myself at all. I'm more a process guy. So like, I have, you know, like rules and which change over time, but, you know, allow me to get through essentially a learning phase and then moving to risk-taking phase so that you get to the right outcome. Now, there's so much that goes into it. I mean, the closest analogy I'd have is, a few years ago, I was lucky enough to run the, raising money, I was lucky enough to run the London Marathon. And that is 16 weeks of training. And the victory or the actual run is not that, that's not the moment that I celebrate. You know, I celebrate the 16 weeks of training and everything that you put into it, which is, I guess, what everyone does. But that's more me, you know, getting through those 16 weeks. And depending on, you know, what the problem is, whether it's a business issue or not, you know, it's all that prep that goes into getting to the right outcome. The outcome is what everyone else sees. But as you and I know, it takes a lot more.
No, absolutely. I'm sure you're familiar with the iceberg analogy, and there's that foundation and that depth, and that really is the journey. So talking of the journey and that incredible foundation, it's a really special year for the Pasha Group because it is, of course, the 50th anniversary of Pasha, and I know that you guys will be celebrating all summer long, no doubt. but what an incredible milestone to reach, especially when you consider that, you know, in the clubbing industry, the average lifespan of a nightlife institution is about 7 years, because it is so hard to sustain, running a club. And so the legacy Pasha has created is of course incredible, but it's also so iconic and so nostalgic on so many levels when you think about the fashion, you know, the AV, the music, how it's all evolved. And you look back at those, you know, infamous pictures and videos of what Pasha was like in the 70s and beyond. But what do you think are some of the key milestones that have helped really shape this legacy and define this brand?
Thank you. I think we're all at Pasha really excited about achieving this milestone, and it's not just, you know, us in the that are in the company now. I mean, everyone who's been and everyone who's been involved, either as an artist, a dancer, or a client, customer, you know, we all sort of celebrate together. So it's a really exciting time. I have to say, I mean, there are various moments in the history of Pasha that stand out. But before, you know, my initial role as COO, so I was running operations on the island. You know, I could tell what it meant to people on the island. So it was almost like it was their business, right? And they come up to you and say, oh, by the way, what's going on this year? Are you going to improve this or that? And by the way, how is that guy, the manager at the door, because his mum wasn't well, you know, is he okay? And so it's a very local business, and it means a lot to everybody. And no wonder you hear, Pasha is Ibiza, Ibiza is Pasha. I then, you know, went from there to my role in development, so expansion of which I'm sure we'll talk about later, but expansion of the group, and I was, you know, even more surprised, because whether I was in Bali or Tokyo in the east, or Tulum or Cabo in the west, you know, everyone had a story about Pasha, how they were there when they were 18. I think they said 16, but when they were 18, and, you know, all the special moments they had there, and how they bought like the t-shirt, the cherries. So it's usually significant for so many people. So it touches people in different ways. So, you know, for me to say, well, it's great because we have a new AV system doesn't really, you know, explain. I think there's some historical context to the journey of Pacha. You know, it was founded in, started in 73. And those were the days where the founder, the legend Ricardo and his brother used to travel to mostly London to, you know, to pick up the music, the LPs and bring them back to Ibiza, and everybody would be waiting for, because they knew they'd be listening to new music. So this was in the 70s. I mean, in the 80s, it was more the Movida culture in Madrid. And you know, Ibiza was still like a small terrace with resident DJs playing for 6 hours, 7 hours. But the real sort of transformation, well, actually then, like in the late 80s, the creativity of Pacha came to the fore, because they would have these iconic parties like Pelos Locos, which is crazy hair, then the beach party where the, you know, the floor was full of sand, the Mr. and Miss Ibiza party, you know, that locals used to die for, to, you know, to come to watch. And so there's all this sort of creativity where it wasn't really about the DJ, it was more about, you know, where everyone who was present there was almost the, you know, the artist or that everybody was coming to see, each other, right? And then I think from the 90s and then the 2000s, I think that's when it became more mainstream, with big sort of record labels coming to Pacha and playing the music and seeing the reaction of the crowd. So it was the real sort of tastemaker of what was going to be successful, what was going to be released or not. And then, of course, in the 2000s, you had, you know, Eric Murillo, Swedish House Mafia, David Guetta, etc. And that was like the big EDM movement. Again, at the forefront of the EDM movement. So, you know, it happened first at Pacha. And then in the 2000s, I think, you know, we pivoted further into sort of underground and tech and deep house, first with Luciano and then with Solomon, which, you know, remains to date. So I think, you know, it's not like it's a 50-year-old club. I mean, it's a 50-year young club, or like, you know, it's constantly changing and evolving. And you can see that, like, you come to Pacha now and it's on trend. It's, you know, it's very exciting. And so, I mean, it's different things to different people. I think, you know, I know it's quite a, you know, broad question. So it's different things for different people, but, you know, we have gone through different phases over the 50 years, and can't wait to see what the next, you know, 50 look like. 100%.
And how is, like, that relationship? It's really nice to you've sort of touched upon that local family feel. You know, it was a farmhouse essentially in the beginning. And how has that sort of relationship sort of changed now with the island as well? Maybe you could talk to us a little bit about that. Where is it at currently? Do you feel like the, you know, the governments are supporting?
Absolutely. I mean, the government has always been supportive, and you know, we do our part, as do most responsible businesses. Anyway, I think that you know, there are competitors in the market that do an excellent job, but like you said, we're sort of farmhouse to super club, but we're still a farmhouse, right? Like, and the others are more sort of big hangar style, aircraft hangar style nightclubs, which is what you see like an industrial venue. I mean, not to knock them at all, but it's very different when it's like coming into a house, you walk through the kitchen to get to the VIP. I mean, we did a big renovation a couple of years ago during COVID. And the point was, you know, okay, we're going to invest in the club. What are the things that we would like to change? So we upgraded the AV, of course, but we enlarged the size of the dance floor, so it was more GA, and reduced the size of the VIP. So, you know, I always say, like, Pacha is more flower power than money power, right?
Great. Now, talking about, you know, the nightlife industry, of course, you know, it is a very difficult industry and there's so many things we have to consider, you know, from the changing legislative perspectives, the consumer preferences. But in your opinion, at the moment, 2023, what do you think are the most significant challenges that the industry faces and how can we sort of navigate through that?
Yes, I think it's not just our industry at the current moment in 2023. I mean, that is, you know, facing difficulty. I think coming out of COVID, that was really difficult for the nighttime industry. You know, I think net-net, the nightlife industry is losing more venues than adding on. So that, you know, that's still yet to turn the corner. But I think, broadly speaking, the issues that we face are on the client side or the customer side will be more the cost of living, that, you know, that affects everybody and the uncertainty. And then I think staff shortages is of course, you know, something that's been written about and talked about a lot. I think, you know, Brexit adds some complexity there. Making it more difficult to recruit, but you know, like all businesses, we've got to work through it and you know, figure out a way. We're absolutely, you know, delighted to come into an iconic venue such as this, the Café de Paris, invest a whole bunch of money in order to, you know, bring it back to the glory of the past. And you know, and we'll have to plow through. I mean, these are the initial years of a 25-year lease, so we're here for a while, and you know, together with the industry, we'll have to overcome all the challenges currently upon us. But you know, that's what business cycles are about. So.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the group has several brands under its umbrella, from Pasha to Destino, Leo, El Hotel, Fatelli and Mykonos. So how do you sort of strike that balance between allowing each to have its unique identity, but still sort of retaining its own sense, you know, of staying under that umbrella and also adapting to like different cultural contexts?
Yeah, no, you're right. It's not, you know, we're not... a one product or one size fits all company. I think that what's important for us to remember, and this goes to, you know, to explain the longevity of the company. I mean, we're a manifestation of the real Ibiza, right? So it's based on creativity and artistry, and so that is at the center of what we do, no matter which, you know, product we talk about. So whether it's the hotels, well, they're not just simply a hotel. There's a restaurant. It's around the pool. It works through the day into the evening. Then we have a party at night, and then so there is a much longer average length of stay almost of experiencing the product at our hotels than any other, right? So. Our non-accommodation revenue is probably one of the highest globally for a hotel, and similarly for other concepts. You know, whether if it's a nightclub, we have a restaurant, you know, that becomes a nightclub, and so on, and the concept that we have here in London, the Leo, which is you know, a dinner show or like a cabaret, a restaurant and a club. So you get to experience all of that. So it's, you go out for an evening of entertainment rather than an evening of dinner or to go to watch a show. So it's being able to combine all these things. So each of these products, I think most importantly, has some of the ethos of Ibiza that we bring to it. And also provides a wider scope of experience rather than just, you know, a simple sort of, I'm going for a show, I'm going to have a meal. So I think that's what you'll find common across the portfolio of products that we have.
And it's so exciting to have Leo in London. So it's an understatement to say that, you know, Pasha has hosted the world's best superstar DJs. I think every superstar DJ has played there. And so when you guys, you know, map out the year, and particularly the season, the summer season ahead, how does the club sort of curate the lineup to ensure that each residency and each performance aligns with the essence, you know, of the Pasha brand?
Yeah, it's probably one of the most exciting, you know, things we do. We, you know, obviously we're working off an existing lineup. So, you know, from last year to this year, we usually change maybe one or two of the residencies, you know, based on feedback, based on, you know, natural longevity, etc. But we like to have a balance between the DJs that we all love to hear and watch, but also to have our own concepts. So, for example, the Flower Power concept that we have, which is a great party. It's music from the 60s and the 70s. It brings together all the generations. So you have youngsters and people who are, you know, who've been coming for over 30, 40 years to enjoy that kind of music. So I think what we like to do is to be on trend with our music, focused around electronic music, but also have our own sort of concept parties in there, which are focused more around the production rather than just simply the, you know, a superstar DJ. So, and that's what clients like, because they don't really want the same thing every day. So it allows for a greater balance. It allows to, you know, widen the customer base that we have and you know, appeal to a greater variety of customers. I think you know, one of the key points for the company around the ethos of the business has always been around openness, inclusivity, and freedom of expression, which I think, you know, which comes from what Ibiza is about. And so that level of openness and inclusivity, increasing the size of the dance floor, or you know, having parties that are not you know, very expensive tickets, but you know, us being able to maintain a control of our production costs allow us to provide more to more people, right? So I think we take all of that quite seriously, being able to give back to the island, to have you know, last year we had a party concept called El Baile, which tracked the history of dance, which is more a celebration of Ibiza. And you know, so those are the kinds of things that that we look at. And you know, through the winter, and you know, even during the season, of course, we're traveling around the world to see what, you know, what the latest trends are. And we maintain our position as tastemakers. So, you know, when we try it, you know, it more often than not, it works.
What's something that surprised you about the industry lately?
I think the resilience, having gone through COVID, you know, it's very easy to be downbeat about something like that. When, you know, it's not just there is a reduction in number of people at the venue. There is no one in the venue. So I think I was really surprised when we reopened the club on the 28th of April last year, so 2022. And I, you know, I said to the managers, I said, okay, have we brought the team in for extra training, given that, you know, we probably have a whole bunch of new people who've joined, you know, given COVID? And they said, I don't know what you're talking about, Sanjay, because 100% of our people have stayed. And, you know, so we don't have any, you know, new person that needs to be trained. Of course, we did the refresher training course. But I think that sort of resilience of the industry generally, and for the people that work at Pasha more specifically, has truly been impressive.
It almost feels like, you know, first of all, the season has become a lot longer now. And it almost, you know, it feels like we're still so grateful for being able to come back, because we were, of course, one of the last industries to really come back in full swing, and, you know, with that almost certainty that we're not going to get shut down next week and we can operate. And of course, there's so many moving parts to operating something like this as well. But looking to the future, what kind of trends and changes in technology do you anticipate will shape the nightlife industry? And what sort of opportunities are you guys looking to leverage to really enhance that sort of clubbers experience, you know, and really stay at the forefront of these changes?
Yeah, I think, as you know, as you say, I think the one thing that's permanent is change itself, right? Like, so, and change goes faster and faster every year. You know, for us to remain relevant and to succeed into the future, we've always got to be at the forefront of innovation and technology, and, you know, whether it's AI or whether, you know, 2 years ago it was all about the metaverse and things like that. So we're constantly evaluating, you know, what we can bring in, but the focus has always been on improving the experience, you know, the experience of clubbers. So when you come now, you see that the you know, the view that the general public have of or the clubbers have of the DJ has improved. The sight lines are better, the music sounds better, the audiovisuals, you know, the screens that we have, the LED screens make the whole experience more vibrant and more entertaining. But we're not into sort of replacing everything with technology, because these are the experiences that, you know, people need to enjoy. We, you know, on the technology side, for like, you know, capacity checks, for making sure, like, ticketing, payment, all that, you know, to make it easier for clubbers to spend less time ordering a drink, but more time actually enjoying the music. I think those are key. But one of the most interesting digital projects that we're working on is digitizing all our back catalog that we have. Interviews from the DJs from the 70s and the 80s. I mean, it's incredible stuff that we can't wait to share with the community, with the Pasha community. You know, to see what your DJs were like, and when the DJs were like underage, and so the father had to sit there and sign the contract, stuff like that. It's great to watch.
Well, that's really, well, it'll be exciting to see that for sure. Now, Sanjay, you studied at LBS, London Business School, an incredible place. I think you got your MBA from there, if I'm not mistaken. So aside from, of course, the learning in the curriculum, how did that experience like shape your knowledge, and just tell us about that journey, really?
Okay. Talking about my MBA, I was very lucky to go to business school, and it's a great, you know, great school here in London, a fantastic city. So I could, of course, combine studying with going out in a fun city. I think that what the MBA kind of, you know, that people don't talk about is how diverse it really is. People from everywhere, and you get to understand these differences and figure out how to celebrate the differences. No, so I know that our group or our class was stronger given, you know, the variety of people we had in the group, rather than having, you know, everyone from the same place, for example. So I think that the strength of diversity is something that I definitely picked up on and have been using since there more forcefully. Of course, with the caliber of the professors, you know, whether it was marketing or entrepreneurship or risk taking, or, you know, all that was obviously helpful. But I think what was most enjoyable was obviously, you know, enjoying the diversity of the students. I think doing the case studies on, you know, similar situations that have happened to other companies is interesting, but, you know, technologies are different, things change, so not everything is really adaptable into the current day. But I think having this sort of network of friends from the school allows you to, you know, pick up on experiences that others may be experiencing at the same time.
Yeah, no, it's so true. I'm sure like you can really observe like global cultures in a really different, you know, firsthand experience sort of way. And as you're talking, actually, I was just thinking, you know, I mean, World Economic Forum says that soft skills is one of the most important skills that we're going to need in this increasingly digitized and automated world. And like, actually, it really, when you're talking about that journey of the dance floor, I mean, what better way to really enhance what those skills are? Because it is about inclusivity and ultimately like connection, right? Either, you know, not only just to the music, but with each other in that room and that energy that everyone's sort of experiencing. You have worn many C-suite hats, from chief operating officer to chief development officer and now CEO of the Pasha Group. So just talk to us about that sort of journey and what you've sort of taken from each, you know, each vantage point.
Yeah, I think that my favorite part from each of the those roles I did talk about already when I said that, you know, because running operations of a nightclub, yeah, I mean, it's great. There's so much learning. There's stuff happening every single night. And, you know, you've got to be there. I do the rounds. I, you know, go to the GA, enter through the GA, walk through the club, the toilets, the, you know, the cash counting room. You walk around into the VIP, back again. And it's great. I learned a lot, and you realize, you know, how passionate everybody is, that works at Pasha, and how important each person is, you know, in the role that they play. But I think you know, what I learned the most was, because this chief operating officer role was obviously in Ibiza, is to see what, you know, what Pasha meant to Ibiza, to the local community. And then after that season, when I transitioned to chief development officer, I mean, what a cool job, right? I was traveling to around the world to, you know, to see where we could expand this very local brand, you know. I mean, it's a global brand with local presence, right? So it was taking the local presence to a global presence. That was the ambition. And then traveling around the world, talking about the brand, and, you know, everyone's sort of doors were open to, they said, and they all would, you know, I spent less time selling Pasha and more time listening to them tell me why Pasha was so incredible, right? So, I mean, it was fantastic. And that experience was very helpful, because, you know, I then could put in place a growth plan rather than, you know, doing it from desktop, or, you know. And then in the role as CEO, now it's a case of managing Ibiza and managing the growth around the world. So I was very lucky that I had, you know, the building blocks that helped me to do a better job as a CEO.
Interesting. And of course, working in the nightlife industry takes a huge toll on, I think, the mind and the body. There's so much, you know, I mean, there's the hours, there's the travel. I mean, you're jumping on a plane straight after this, you're traveling every week. What are some of the non-negotiable habits you have around health and really, you know, just succeeding in this industry?
I don't talk about this a lot, but I do think that it is one of the sort of foundations to for me to be able to do my job and to do it well, right? So health's really important. I mean, I think I mentioned earlier, I eat one meal a day, and so I fast for 22, 23 hours, and I eat once. It increases the amount of time that I have to do other stuff, and keeps me focused and attentive to, you know, all the various you know, things that I need to do during the day. I read a lot. I read a book a week, but I'm probably reading four or five at the same time, so it takes time for me to get through various books. It's not that all the books are economics or business or nightlife, or, you know, I have different streams of book lists that come to me. So I have a varied reading profile, and that helps me sort of focus, concentrate on, again, you know, the things at hand. I think that the reading, the diet, I think exercise is difficult because, you know, conflicting demands on time, but also when you fly, you come off a plane. I don't really want to go straight from a plane onto a treadmill. I exercise when I can, but I think the meditation or, you know, taking time every day, however long it is, whether it's a few minutes or 20 minutes, I think to focus the mind has also, you know, helped me a lot. I think I don't know whether it's part of really this question, but I have a way of managing my day, which then translates into the week or the month, which is to worry about the here and now. So they're basically four pieces. You know, like the first bit is the here and now. So any issues that we face today that need to be addressed today, and believe me, every day there is something, right? And then the second bit is the 2 weeks to go. So you look ahead 2 weeks. I'm looking at reservations across, or the booking profile across, you know, for all our events 2 weeks to go, and trying to see where there are gaps. And the better job you do on the 2 weeks to go, of course, it reduces the number of issues you have on the day, right? So the first is on the day, then there's 2 weeks to go. The third is more sort of construction projects around the world. So at the moment, we're building in Dubai, we're building in Palma, Mallorca, is coming to a close. It should be open on the 1st of August, and we're building in Marbella. So, you know, the constructions are the stuff that's for the future, the growth, and the pipeline of opportunity. And finally, the strategic, right? Like the digital strategy, the music strategy. There's so much more that we could be doing around music to maintain our a prominent position in electronic music, and so the strategic side. So I think there's stuff on the health and mindfulness area, but there's also sort of clear discipline on how I control my and manage my my day. I think all sort of comes together.
No, it totally makes sense. I think you have to be so structured in having that routine, especially when you're like traveling so much, and being able to like go from time zone to time zone and know like this is what I'm gonna, you know, focus on, because we are sometimes creatures of habit, but also setting up your mind to like really succeed and take that, you know, for what it is. And so talking about, you know, the resilience of the mind and really like training the mind, can you share maybe or recall a specific failure that led to a breakthrough moment?
I think that, you know, I say this to my kids a lot, right? Like obviously everyone talks about learning, right? And where do learnings come from? And I think for me, learnings come from listening, listening, reading, traveling, right? And I suppose experiences, because experiences cover the first three buckets, but experiences. So when you say, you know, a failure, then, you know, that's a learning, right? It's part of the learning. So for me, they're all sort of, you know, a failure is like traveling. It provides you with information that you then process, and then you figure out a way of using that to become victorious, as per my name, right? Like one day. I mean, opening restaurants in London, I've opened six, and at the moment only two are open. So I suppose I've had failures with four of my restaurants, which we closed during COVID, but, you know, which have provided huge learning opportunities for me, which is why one of the restaurants here is, that I'm involved with, is, you know, has music, like is full, you know, a longer stay, because it provides music and food and like an after party and things like that. So there's a lot that failure teaches you, just as much as, you know, reading about it or listening to people talk about it, etc. So, you know, I embrace failures. I don't think that there is any one that stands out, because I don't give it that kind of position, perhaps.
Interesting way to look at it. And I think sometimes also it's the ones who can stay the longest, you know, that that really, you know, are there to take, you know, those opportunities and transform the failures as well. Because it's easy to give up and just walk away, right? But yeah, if someone came up to you, Sanjay, and said, "Hey, look, Sanjay, you know, I want to open up a club," what would you tell them?
I'd be very, very happy because I think we need to turn that corner. And, you know, I think customers understand, you know, when clubs start closing, you know, it makes people more nervous to actually come. It's not like, you know, you're the last man standing, so everyone gets there. It's not good for business. And then you need to have more people being trained in the industry. So for that, you need more people. So of course, it would be a fantastic piece of news to hear that somebody's, you know, is opening a club. Of course, you have to be wary. And, you know, in London and in any competitive market, you could tick all the boxes and say, great venue, great design, great food, or great music. And you could tick every box and it could still not work. But like I said, you know, I'm a creature of process. So if you keep doing that often enough, then you will definitely get there. And the other thing I'd say is that, you know, one mustn't think that you're fighting this battle by yourself. You can speak to competition. Like, you know, I'm always sort of very happy to help others coming into the industry or competing because I think it makes all of us stronger. So I think reach out and use the network and, you know, speak to competition, figure out how to make to improve the chances.
No, I definitely agree. So we have a section in our podcast where we allow our audience to sort of submit some questions. And we've had two interesting questions come in. One's from Annika, who's a music producer from London. And she basically asked, what's the biggest myth about working in the nightlife industry?
I think the one I hear most often is that it's always party, right? Like it's always a party. But those in the industry know that it is fun, right? It is fun because other people are having fun, and you are there providing them or facilitating that the fun that they're experiencing. I think that it's important to understand the difference between you know, this industry is tough. The hours are long. The hours sometimes are more nighttime than daytime. And so it's important that you enjoy your work and you enjoy the industry. But you have to understand the difference between enjoying the industry and enjoy working in the industry, which is to provide that enjoyment to others, right? It doesn't mean you can't enjoy it, but you probably enjoy it elsewhere.
Yeah, it's so true. Otherwise, you get trapped. And it's very easy to get trapped, of course. The other question we had from Damon in DC was sort of like, what's your advice on sort of managing like fatherhood and balancing, you know, parenthood and clubbing, you know, which isn't easy as well.
No, great question. I have two kids. My they're older now. I mean, she's 20, and my son is 17. But yes, I mean, it's difficult to balance, especially if you have a young family. And you know, you've got to set your boundaries and delegate where you can and get support of your team, etc. Because the worst thing to do is, you know, is to cause damage both to the business and to the family, because, you know, any pressures you have in family will obviously come back to your work. So I'm not denying it, but there are many industries where it is difficult, right? Like balancing family, it's always complicated. But I think it's helpful if they enjoy, you know, it depends how old they are, but if they enjoy music and they enjoy going out, then it does make it easier and more fun.
And getting quality time, of course, and making that also like a priority, I'm sure. So final sort of section of our podcast is a quick fire round. Much more lighthearted questions. What was the last song you either downloaded or streamed?
Okay. I'd say one of the latest a kind of music track that I heard at Pasha and was fantastic. It's called Les Gouttes. And another, the Adriatic remix of Moth to a Flame. I think, yeah, I didn't realize I didn't have it. I was listening to that at in Mykonos last week. It was a fantastic set.
Nice, nice. At what time of the day do you get your best work done?
Yeah, this is difficult because it's typically in the morning, or when I wake up, and this when I wake up, it depends on when I went to bed. No, so if I finish at Pasha at 5-6 in the morning, then yeah. But I think the first thing when I wake up is usually the best. You know, 3 minutes or up to 20 minutes of meditation, and the mind is fresh, and you know, I clarity of thought and get stuff done.
Brilliant. How have you changed the most over the last year?
Oh, wow. My goodness. Yeah, I think the family would probably give you a different answer. But I think spending time in Ibiza and understanding the energy of the island and its people have made me slow down and improve my listening skills. And so I think I'm more focused, more aware, and more present when I'm, you know, with other people. And I think that really has helped me in business as well to make better decisions, ironically for Pasha in the end.
And if you could be remembered for one thing, what would it be?
Oh my God. I think from a Pasha point of view, I think, you know, I'd love to be remembered as perhaps, you know, because the Pasha story will continue for another 50 years and beyond, someone who took the group towards its global ambition. Whilst embracing, you know, changes in technology. I think that would be something that would be special for me. Yeah.
Well, it's a mega, mega trend about the hitting, so it'll be very exciting to see where you take that. Have you ever tried DJing or producing music?
Well, I'm a lot better in front of the DJ than the DJ deck, you know, rather than behind. So I leave that to the experts, and I stick to my ever-improving dancing skills.
Okay, cool. And our final question that we always love to round off is, what are you most grateful for this month?
I'm most grateful for the time with my family, really, because I do travel a lot, and they're great, and they, you know, they've been fantastic throughout my time at Pacha. And they're highly supportive. I've been married 22 years. So, yeah, my wife's fantastic. And yeah, just the time with my family.
Beautiful. Well, that's a lovely note to end on. Thank you so much for welcoming us into Leo here in this gorgeous space. Yeah, have a safe flight.
I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we've enjoyed having these conversations. If you want to grab a copy of today's show notes, then head over to missionmakers.com, where you'll also find notes from all of our previous episodes. And if you're interested in talking to me about producing podcasts or coming down to my music and motorsports events, then you can reach out to me at missionmakers or at dj.n1nja on Instagram. The music played in today's episode is an exclusive preview of my upcoming track, Infinite Being, with Deepak Chopra, and it will be coming out early next year. This has been a Mission Makers production. Thank you as ever for listening. And until next time, keep it laser focused.
We're not talking about mind, which is a modified expression of what we call the self. Self is fundamental reality, fundamental being. We call ourselves human beings, not human thinkers, not human doings, but human beings. So, right now, as you're listening to me, if you were just try this, as you're listening to me, be aware of that which is listening.